Accession number 27084, Reel 4.
Mr. Benjamin, you said you didn't think there was something these things.
As far as I remember, they weren't in. They didn't really deploy their nuclear boats around into the Indian Ocean. And that wasn't sort of top of our priorities. At least, as far as I remember, it wasn't. Anyway, on to Singapore, where we spent a sort of absorption into the Far East Fleet period. And then we went all the way back to cover the withdrawal from Aden. And this was an interesting period. It was the last phases of our time in Aden. There was a large naval task force, carriers, commando ships, to cover the withdrawal in the event of any problems. And we had an interesting time.
In what way?
Oh, I think it was just being part of a sort of tri-service operation. I was just trying to look at various things we did. We must have withdrawn on about the November the 24th. It says fly pass for High Commissioner. There was, I note from my logbook, a datum investigation, which means that someone must have suspected there might be a submarine that wasn't one of ours or the thing around, perhaps looking and seeing what we were doing. It could well have come down from the Gulf. So there obviously was a slight worry about that. But
now, there was a fair amount of military conflict of one sort or another going on there. Were you involved in any way?
No, by that stage, most of the military problems had been a few months earlier. There was old Mad Mitch and his and that side. There was the business further up country, yeah, where there'd been operations. But on the whole, by the time they saw us going, it was reasonably quiet. I know you assumed that the terrorism was still around, but there weren't really many incidents that happened whilst we were there during the withdrawal. But it was quite a long period sitting off there. And again, interesting flying, not much ASW flying, but a lot of general flying. I mean, you know, unslung loads of all the old fridges, which we found a home for, and things like that. Eagle itself was, I think, as aircraft carriers go, was a happy, well-run ship with a very enjoyable wardroom. Being part of an air group, all, you know, our sort of average age must be about 25.
So you were the old man of the
party. We were the old man, senior pilot. You were getting on a bit, 31, 32. But it was a young man's business, and we had, again, tremendous fun. I think that we were, from the aviation point of view, a very efficient carrier. And luckily, there weren't too many accidents.
Did this reflect only Pope's character?
Yes, I think he was a very good leader. He was a very good captain, I thought.
Anyway, Christmas in Singapore, and after the Aden withdrawal, and that was a fairly quiet period until we re-embarked again in February, and we went off back. We went down via the Cocos Islands down to Australia and visited Perth, and that was again nice to be back in Australia. And Perth, Western Australia, was again a wonderful visit. In between the whiles, we exercised with the USN off the Philippines, and then went back to stand off Aden for a period.
Again?
Yes, when they were worried that something might go wrong. So we did a second sort of whack of that. But nothing much happened. And we called in at Cape Town on the way home. And
was the ship too big to go through the Suez Canal, or was that closed to...
No, Suez, that was, I should have mentioned that. The reason why we went down by Cape Town, of course, was that 67 war.
Oh, 67
yeah.
war.
Yeah, and so Cape Town, that was why the government, as it were, had to allow us to go to Cape Town.
Yes.
Anyway, back at the in June, and...
So you're now June 68.
It's June 68. Eagle gave leave, and we had a sort of brief break before re-embarking in August to go up to north of Scotland for the big autumn NATO exercise. And that was, you know, back to reality. It was the first time we could, for a long time, we could get on with some proper ASW work, where there was the prospect of submarines, the other end of it, and
which, of course, were other NATO submarines,
yes,
acting as the enemy.
That's right, and of course, there were the Russians around as well, observing, and so that all went.
Did you ever find any Russian submarines?
No, I don't think we did. But
is this because they kept one out of it?
Yes, I think they didn't. Yeah, I think once or twice we had contact, which was, you know, unexplained, but one never really had a sort of positive track of Soviet submarines. That came
Can you just answer a simple technical question? When you put the pod, or whatever it is, into the water, what is the range of that?
Said our dam, I suppose 2,000-3,000 yards.
Oh, very, very tiny, then.
Yes, it is. I think I've got it right. 2,000-3,000
yards. So
that could be
a submarine 5 miles away, and you wouldn't know it.
Yeah, I think, yes. I'm afraid my memory is so bad that I can't remember exactly what the range, but it wasn't very far. It wasn't very powerful. Anyway, left Eagle, an 820 squadron, in November 68, and then converted to the Wessex 3, which was a much more sophisticated version of the Wessex 1, with a radar, the 195 sonar, and a much more reliable and steady flight control system for the night work. And I converted the Wessex 3 because I'd been appointed to command 819 Squadron over in Northern Ireland in... January. And so
January of 69.
So January 69, we all packed up, and I went over to Northern Ireland, and shortly followed, and Sarah and the children arrived shortly afterwards. It was quite interesting that the night they arrived, Aldergrove was completely fogged in, and they said no aircraft's coming up from London. Then suddenly they announced it was coming after all. And Sarah had been going from Bristol anyway, that had been shipped up to Heathrow, got on this aircraft with the two children. The first people off the aircraft were Paisley and his henchmen after the egg-throwing incident at St. Paul's. And they, obviously, under instructions to get Paisley out of the the mainland, off the mainland as quickly as possible. Anyway, we settled into a married quarter down near at Campsie. And 819 Squadron's job was to support the Joint Anti-Submarine School, which was at HMS Seagull in London, which is now Shackleton Barracks. And we provided the helicopter support to train the ships.
So to a certain extent, we knew where some of the submarines were in order to make the exercise profitable and realistic, and so did a lot of that with the anti-submarine courses. The other thing we had to provide was the protection for the deploying SSBNs out of Faz Lane. So if an SSBN was going on patrol, we did various ASW patrols in the hours, days preceding to make sure that there was no Russian submarine there which could latch on to
and follow it.
Follow it, because that's the obvious place to pick them up,
yes,
before they get out into the deep water. So that was part of our job. We used to go over to Prestwick Airport and operate out of there to do that. But of course, the other thing that was, and we did various NATO exercises, embarked in either the Fleet Auxiliary Tankers or HMS Engadine. But the background of all this was, of course, the Northern Ireland troubles.
Which started at the end of the year.
They'd started, really, the civil rights marches in the autumn of 68. And by the time we got there in 69, there was all the problem of squatters, and Sarah had a thing, so what to do if a squatter arrives? You'll find a squatter in your married quarter, and things like that. And the tension was beginning to build up. And it was interesting from the 819 squadron point of view, because I had all the Fleet Air Arms Irishmen. I had Protestants, I had Catholics. I had those from the north, those from the south, who joined the Royal Navy. I had English Scots or Scots who had married Derry girls, and the pull of the Derry girl to get their man back to the area is pretty powerful. And it was a very happy community inside the wire. And of course, the difficulty for them was that once they left the base and went back either to where they lived, maybe some, or the weekend at Belfast, they would go back to their sort of roots. And the most difficult time, I think, was when we were in Norway, in Engadine, in August, when the first major riots took place, when the army was called in. And of course, you couldn't telephone in those days easily. And trying to glean from the Norwegian papers what was happening, it was a worrying time for an awful lot of them who'd got their families involved. And I had one, my electrical officer came from the south, I had one of my observers came from Newry, the rest of us were either English or Scots. And so you had the officers, on the whole, were English Scots, and all the troops were Irish. And it was, so, looking back on it, it was, you know, you had to be quite sensitive. But the command was fun. I was on my own on an Air Force base. My captain, Tony Morton, was 16 miles down the road at Seagull, and I was left alone to get on and command.
Were you still a lieutenant commander?
I was still a lieutenant commander.
Right.
And so that was a very happy and interesting period. We loved Ireland. We used to be able to go to Donegal, really until the end, or down to Dublin if we wanted to for a weekend. It was just beginning to get a bit awkward by the time I left at the end of the year, because I'd been summoned down to the MOD to go and be the pilot appointer, in other words, the person who decides which pilot goes to which squadron and do all that.
I was wondering when the MOD would rear its head.
Yes, well, it reared it slightly earlier than I'd thought it would. But anyway, I went down to and took up this appointment in Mod, and on the second or third day, I'd been taking over the job. My predecessor hadn't even left, because there's quite a long handover I was summoned to see the director, who was Ronnie Forrest, to be told there'd been a tremendous mistake that the probation board had not done what the previous probation board had advised them, that I'd been promoted, and therefore was to stop taking over this job, which was not a commander's job. And so I was slightly left in limbo. My family was still in Ireland, so I went back to Ireland and laid low, knowing I'd been promoted but not able to say so, and having to try and explain why I wasn't doing the job everybody expected. Anyway, it all got sorted out, but I had to leave Ireland at the end of the year, and they found me another job in the MOD to do for 6 months to a year before I went off to sea as a commander. It was quite amusing that the job that I went to in the MOD was one that I had discussed when I was taking over the appointing job to be told by my predecessor that was a non-job, one of the least important, and we needn't bother about finding a successor for that one for some time. Anyway, it all changed. And I went to the Department of, or Directorate of Naval Recruiting under a most wonderful boss, Captain Mike Sylvester, who was an air engineer. And the recruiting organisation was run by a combination of retired officers or extended service officers, the careers organisation, and I was, I suppose, the only sort of junior generalist officer in the setup. I found my job, it was policy and plans, but in fact, it was mostly doing the advertising for the Navy. It was the days where we used to take full-page spreads in the colour supplements, and these needed quite a lot of facilities to produce the photograph. And so I used to trail around the fleet with the creative director of the advertising agency who got our account and the photographer, setting up these shots. And we went the photographer we used was he belonged to the agency, but he was a tremendous diver, amateur diver, and photographer, underwater photographer. And I must say, one's got to admire the guts of this chap. He'd get in his diving suit into the water, fast patrol boat coming absolutely straight at him whilst he got there, and we got some most wonderful photographs. And it was absolutely fascinating working with an advertising agency. You saw the Navy through completely different eyes. I don't think they probably had much time for the Navy, but they'd got the account, and therefore the Navy was the most important thing to produce the goods. And I got involved in some marvellous things. There was the Wren's recruiting film, I always remember the director of Wren's. We went off to some cinema in Soho to see the rough cuts of the film, and it was all designed to get girls to join the Wren's at the ordinary level, not as necessary as officers, and it was all slightly racist stuff. There was love, and what a wonderful time you'll have as a Wren, barbecues in the setting sun, and all this sort of thing. And at the end of it, she just harumphed and said, "I don't know on earth what my public schoolgirls are going to think of this." And we said, "It's not for your public schoolgirls." anyway, that was it was a fascinating period. And I wrote one or two papers on the future structure of recruiting and what to do about this, that and the other. But the great thing was it gave me a year of experience of the civil service and of how MOD works. Not particularly arduous, but interesting, and a bit of travel. And I had a very happy time there.
Were these the first appreciation papers you'd written since you'd done your training at Greenwich?
Yes, they were, really. It was the first time I'd had to. I mean, you wrote a report of proceedings when you were CO of your squadron, and you did the officer reporting, obviously. It was a part of life. But that was the first time I'd really had to take my pen out. On probation to commander in that job, of course, you knew that your frontline aviation career
was coming to an end.
And so the next sort of target was which destroyer or frigate am I going to be given command of? And I wasn't given command of a destroyer or frigate, probably a good thing too, but I was sent a second command of HMS Norfolk, which was the last of the, or second last of the county class to be built. It was brand new, and so for the second time in my career I found myself joining a new county class destroyer.
So this is the same as Devonshire?
Same as Devonshire.
But 10 years younger?
Yes. And I would obviously, I was very happy, I knew the ship, knew how they worked, and went down to take over a ship that was just coming out of its trials programme. It had been running for about 6 months, I suppose, 4 months, and was doing all its trials. And the job was to get the ship out of, get it accepted into service with a fairly dull trials programme around Portsmouth. And then we were going to do firings out in the Mediterranean and things like that. And my time in Norfolk as commander, I think 820 was a very happy time. And obviously I enjoyed my command, but being commander of Norfolk with a wardroom of 30, 35 officers, a ship which once we got off the Part 4 programme had an interesting programme. We went down to the Mediterranean, and it was a very enjoyable time. And I suppose one of the more interesting or things that made it more interesting was that it was the first ship that the Prince of Wales went to sea in after leaving Dartmouth, and so we had him for nearly a year. And again, that was something which was absolutely fascinating. I mean, dealing with the palace team on all these various issues, having him as a young officer in the ship, trying to balance this business of being an ordinary naval officer with also being, you know, at what point did he revert to being royal family again? The problems of security and trying to protect his private life so that he could enjoy himself as much as possible.
And what age was he at this?
He must have been 21, 22, that sort of age.
So this is post-Cambridge then?
Yes, post-Cambridge, post-doing his flying with the Air Force. And he joined in Gibraltar in October, November 1972, I think it must have been. Yes, 1972. And went and left in August 73. But it was fascinating. And the other interesting thing was to watch at fairly close hand his relationship with Mountbatten, because we were in Portsmouth for quite a lot of the time in Norfolk, for one reason or another. And I said, you know, the evenings, I had quite a few arguments with some of the powers that be, who said, oh, I gather you're letting him sleep ashore at Broadlands. I said, yes, because unlike the rest of us in Portsmouth, if we want to go off to the pub or Bosom and things, we can do that, and we can have a break. It is difficult, if not impossible, for him to do the same. He's got Broadlands nearby where he's happy, and therefore if there's no work and no purpose for him to be on board, well, why doesn't he go there? I mean, it's fine if he's officer of the day or something like that, then there's no question. But you've got to understand that he can't have a what we call a run ashore, like the rest of us. So he used to go off to Broadlands quite a lot, which was, I think, you know, made life in Portsmouth tolerable, and it was quite clear that he adored Mountbatten.
Who had now, of course, long since ceased to be CDS.
He'd retired, and he came down once to others, said, he said, would it be all right if my great uncle came to lunch in the wardroom? I said, yeah, sure, we'd better tell the captain. And went to the captain, and Bill Cook, who was absolutely marvellous. He said, oh, when's he coming? And I said, Tuesday. I'm in London that day. And he said, but he's having lunch in the ballroom so far. Now, an awful lot of people would have adjusted their program to be there. Bill didn't. And so it actually worked a treat because, you know, Charles, like any other naval officer, to have his great uncle to lunch in the ballroom without the whole ship coming to halt. And it was marvellous. My Madden was going on to the Isle of Wight afterwards. And as I was saying goodbye to him off the gangway, his ADC from the lifeguards, there, I was saying goodbye, Admiral, and there was, come on, Colonel, you're late, from the bottom of the gangway. Quite when he made the transition, I'm not sure.
What was your reflections of him? What was your appreciation of him?
Charles?
No.
It was Charles or Mountbatten?
Mountbatten first.
Mountbatten. Oh, I think you've got, you know, I mean, it was before the biographies that have started to question his talents had come out. He was a name. One assumed that he was as competent as, at all the things in the Navy as his rank suggests. I think it's rather sad that I think probably his fellow officers, if you would ask them at the time, would have told you exactly what Mountbatten was. But there was no doubt about it. He was extremely successful. He was a tremendous leader. He got this terribly powerful personality. And he got things done. I mean, I was always brought up on the... Archie Wavell was a tremendous friend of my grandparents, and Archie and Queenie. And so I was brought up on the Wavell view of India. That it could have been done slower and with less loss of life. I'm not so sure. I was brought up to think that Mountbatten had scuttled out rather too quickly in India. But that was purely from my family who were prejudiced. I think that he was devoted to the Navy, and he fought tooth and nail for it. I got to name, or at least I got to see the Mountbatten effect a little more when I went off to be Edward Ashmore's naval assistant in the First Sea Lord's office, where some of his machinations, you were in on some of the machinations, and you started to wonder a little bit. But I think he did a lot for communications when he was a commander. He was a very good leader. I mean, people followed him. And I think the sailors enjoyed him. And he did, you know, we did get out of India. And I mean, I know there was a lot of Hindu and Muslim loss of life, but there wasn't much British loss of life. I mean, you know, he got our own troops, as it were, away. So I think history is perhaps being a bit unkind to him. But I think Philip Ziegler's biography is pretty good. And then there's the Richard Huff, is it?
Yes, Huff.
His one. But I think the Navy was better for having Mountbatten than not having him. But, and he did achieve an almost immense amount, I think, on the tri-service side. I mean, I think he really did put some purpledom on the map, and I think was genuinely purple. So there we are.
Sir Benjamin, thank you. This is the end of this tape, so we'll...
Right.